Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hello, ladies and gents. How are you doing? My podcast is made possible thanks to several things: your donations and also support from sponsorship. Now, on the subject of donations, you can still send me contributions, donations, if you'd like to help me to keep making these episodes. That's a very sincere way for you to say thank you. If you have sent me a donation recently, then I would like to thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you very much. You are helping to keep this podcast alive. I always appreciate your support, but I don't want to keep asking for handouts all the time. So I also have sponsors that help me to keep doing these episodes. One of those sponsors is iTalki, and I'm happy to tell you about their services because they could really be helpful to you and your English. Everybody knows that speaking English with people regularly is vital for proper development of good communication skills, fluency, and clear pronunciation. But it can be hard to find the right people to talk to. But you can find people using iTalki. They have lots of qualified teachers and native speakers of English. Perhaps, for example, you could find someone from the UK. And those people are ready and waiting to talk to you and to help you with your language development. And when you buy some talking time, iTalki will send you a voucher worth one free lesson. To get started, you can go to teacherluke.co.uk/talk or click an iTalki logo on my website. You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Hello, folks. Welcome back to Luke's English Podcast. I hope you're doing well today, wherever you are and whatever exciting things you might be doing at this very moment. You're now listening to episode, which one is this? I think this is episode 489, which is called A Rambling Conversation with Mum, Part 2, plus Vocabulary. So, yes, the rest of my conversation with my mum. This is Part 2, which means that you should listen to Part 1 first, because that's how numbers work. You know that, don't you? Of course you do. Of course you know that. But if you're embarking on this episode without having heard Part 1, then I softly advise you to listen to Part 1 beforehand, okay? So I softly advise you, because at the end of the day, I'm not the sort of person who's going to force you to do things, but it's just a recommendation from me to you. You might want to hear Part 1 first, for obvious reasons. Okay, then. In this conversation, you're going to hear my mum and me wittering on about various things, including the bookshop where my mum works, because she works in a bookshop. Also, some of the books that she's read recently, and some of her podcast and film recommendations as well. The conversation is about 45 minutes long, and then after that, I'm going to go through, that's not how you say that word. What happened to my face when I said that? Go through. That's not how I normally speak. After the conversation, I'm going to go through lots of the vocab that comes up naturally in the conversation, which should be a good way to help you build your vocabulary so that you end up speaking the kind of English that my mum speaks or that I speak. Okay? That sounds good, doesn't it? Yes, it does. Okay, good. I'm glad you agree. All of the vocab that will be explained in the second half of this episode is presented to you in a big list on the page for this episode. So I suggest that you check that out if you're serious about learning this language, and I mean English. If you're really serious about learning English, then all you need to do is just sort of go the extra mile and pay attention while I'm explaining the vocab, and visit the page on the website where you'll actually see the words and expressions with some definitions and little example sentences from the conversation. Okay. All right then. Good. So now you know what to expect. Let's get started. Let's get straight into it. And let's carry on with this conversation with my lovely mum. And here we go. As well as being a volunteer at Unlocking Warwick, what else do you do? What else do you do with yourself?
Well, on the subject of books, I also work in a second-hand bookshop.
Okay.
I work in an Oxfam bookshop, to be precise.
What's Oxfam?
Well, I think most people will know what Oxfam is, won't they? It's an English charity. It was founded in England, in Oxford, in the early 1940s. And it's a charity that goes out and helps people at times of crisis or, you know, during famines or, you know, all that sort of thing. They go out and they help people with, you know, practically with food and water and teaching them how to build shelters and, you know, all that sort of thing.
Relief work.
That's the word.
Relief work and aid.
At times of crisis, usually.
Okay.
But I think they do have an ongoing program of helping people.
Mm-hmm. It's a charity.
It is. And in this country, they've always had for a long time, they've had charity shops, Oxfam charity shops, where people can take their unwanted stuff and it's sold in the shops. And all the profit obviously goes to Oxfam. Well, Oxfam specialise in bookshops as well. And there's one in Knowle, which is near where we used to live.
Yeah.
And I volunteer there. I've been there volunteering there for about 12 years now. And it's great because I like books so much. So I enjoy selling them and talking to people about them.
Yeah.
It's hard work sometimes, but it's great.
Can you just describe what the bookshop looks like?
Well, it just looks like an ordinary bookshop. I mean, in fact, it's a very nice... Well, it does. What do you mean? What does it look like?
No, all right. So just considering the fact that, you know, people who are listening to this, they might be in Russia or China or Japan
or
Spain.
Well, they must have bookshops.
Yeah, of course they've got bookshops, yeah. But, I mean, what I mean by that is that the location of your bookshop, it's on the high street of a little village in the Warwickshire countryside, Solihull,
yes.
Technically.
Yeah.
It's a bookshop on a high street in an English village.
Yeah.
And the street, I mean, the building, how old do you reckon that building is? Have you got any idea?
Ooh. I would have thought certainly Victorian, maybe earlier than that.
So it's a couple of hundred years old.
Probably.
150 years old or something. And it's like this little shop on a row of terraced shops.
Yeah, next door to a hotel, actually. We've got a hotel on one side and an Indian restaurant on the other.
What else do you need? Indian restaurant, hotel and a bookshop. You could just live. You could just. That's all you need, really.
In fact, we're quite near the end of the row of shops, you know, not really an ideal position, but we do very well. We're very popular. We have lots of people who come in, you know, time and time again. And we also manage to get lots of new people in as well. People manage to find us, even though we're not in the most brilliant location.
Yeah.
It's a great shop. It's not very big, but we're very proud of it, all us volunteers who work there, and we work very hard to make it look as attractive as possible and to put out all the best books, because of course all the books are donated. Mm-hmm. We don't have to pay for any of them, but it means we can't choose, you know, we just have to have what we get. And obviously we get some really good books and some not so good, and so we're very careful to put out all the really good books and display them well, and talk to people about them if they need us to.
Okay.
And take a great pride in it.
It's a very pretty shop, I have to say.
Yes, it is. I think it's nice. I don't know why, but I've been to lots of Oxfam bookshops. Every time I go anywhere in the country and there's an Oxfam bookshop, I always go in. And ours, I think, is better than most. I think it's because we've got some nicer shelves, which helps. I don't know where they came from, but they seem a bit nicer than the standard Oxfam bookshop shelves, which are sort of metal.
Yeah, because yours are wooden shelves.
Yes, yeah, we've got wooden units, and that looks much better.
And you also got a nice wooden floor, haven't you?
No, we haven't actually.
Haven't you?
We've just got plastic tiles kind of on the floor. Nothing very special.
I thought it was wooden floorboards.
No, well, there you go. You see, you had that sort of feeling about it when you came in, but we haven't.
I've imagined the wooden floorboards.
You have.
But I mean,
you are imagining it's the sort of place that would have nice wooden floorboards.
And Hugh Grant works there, doesn't he?
I wish.
Really? Would you like to work with Hugh Grant?
Not really, no.
Who would you like to work with if you could have if you could pick one male celebrity and one female one, who would they be? You can work with one male and one female.
Well, you know which male I'd like to work with, don't you?
Alan Bennett.
Yeah. But he's far too old to be working in an Oxfam bookshop.
He could just sit in the corner and
and talk.
He could sit in a leather armchair and tell stories. I can't.
Now, don't take the Mickey.
I can't do an impression of Alan Bennett.
No, you
at
don't
all.
Sound anything like him.
I sound like Jeffrey Boycott, not Alan Bennett. That would be your bloody nightmare, wouldn't it? Having him in the shop.
God.
Now look, Jill, you're stacking them books all wrong.
I think you'll find, Jill, you shouldn't have done it like that. Now, if I was doing it, I would do it like that.
When I went out to bat, did I take books under my arm? I didn't, did I, Jill? Anyway, that's Jeffrey Boycott, a famous English cricket player who's also...
He's a professional Yorkshireman of the worst kind, whereas Alan is a Yorkshireman of the very best kind.
Right. So, yeah, Jeff Boycott, sort of an opinionated cricket player. But Alan Bennett was he still is, a writer, a poet?
No, I've never seen any poetry.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure he does write it, but I don't think he does it publicly.
He's a writer, he's a playwright and a writer of comedy, right?
He started out in Beyond the Fringe, which is a very famous English comedy group. In the late 50s, early 60s, with Jonathan Miller, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. And they did what do you call that, those kinds of shows?
A review? No.
That's right.
A review.
Sort of, yeah, little scenes, little skits.
Sketch show.
Yeah, sketches.
Stage-based sketch show. Mm. They were pioneers of the genre, of the of the English sketch series.
I think so.
What they did was mainly on stage.
Yeah.
They started in Cambridge.
Two of them came from Cambridge. I think Peter Cook and Jonathan Miller were at Cambridge, and Dudley and Alan were from Oxford.
It's interesting.
And I think it is, isn't it? Because they're
shorter. Because they're shorter than the other two.
Well, yeah, but they are also what you might call working class, and the other two are much more patrician, Peter Cook and Jonathan Miller.
Listeners, we're talking about a group called Beyond the Fringe, who were around in the early 1960s, and they did comedy on stage, and they were really, really influential. And from Beyond the Fringe, we got these four guys who went on to do really great work in other areas, particularly in comedy. Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, I did an episode about them once on this podcast. Brilliant. Both of them, absolutely hilarious. And then Jonathan Miller and Alan Bennett went on to do other kinds of work. And all four of them just did brilliant work.
Jonathan Miller and Alan Bennett were more the two more academic members.
Yeah. But you mentioned that Peter Cook and Jonathan Miller were the ones who went to Cambridge.
I think that's right, yes.
Yeah. We think. And
Dudley and Alan were at Oxford.
Dudley and Alan were at Oxford. And you know why I thought that was funny? Like, because they were Dudley and Alan, being the shorter ones who went to Oxford. It's like Monty Python, because Monty Python's Flying Circus is a similar story. They came out of Oxford and Cambridge universities, but it was John Cleese and Graham Chapman who were the tallest, and they went to Cambridge. And Terry Jones and Michael Palin, who were the shorter ones, they went to Oxford. So I don't know if it's got anything to do with height.
Well, I think you'll find that Alan's quite tall, actually.
Oh, is he really? Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm just making it fit the
you
theory.
Are.
It's like the wooden floorboards in your shop.
I'm just
imagining it there, obviously. Yeah. Okay, so you'd have Alan Bennett. If you could choose to work with someone, you'd have Alan Bennett sitting in a chair talking to you.
Yeah.
What about the female companion?
Goodness me. Oh, my goodness. I can't think.
Oof, it's a difficult one, isn't it?
It is.
Oof. Is there a writer?
Oh, well, I would,
or
of
broadcaster?
Course, someone that came to mind, of course, is Victoria Wood, but can't have her anymore because she's dead, unfortunately.
Well, we can
bring her back to life,
yeah,
can we?
Yeah, we. I can speak to some people.
Okay. I wish you would.
Victoria Wood. Who's that then? Or who was that?
Well, she was another comedian who came from Lancashire, I think. Very, very funny. How did she start out? Did she start out as a stand-up or did she start out... Oh, I know how she started out. It was when there was that Saturday night show with... Oh, God, I can't remember her name. There was a Saturday night show and she was on... playing the piano and singing funny songs.
Oh, I know. The Saturday night show was called That's Life.
That's it.
With Esther Ranson.
Esther Ranson. That was the name. I couldn't remember. That's how she came to people's,
attention.
Noticed. And then she became a stand-up. And then she started writing sitcoms and plays. And she was wonderful.
Yeah.
Really amazing.
Really funny.
Yeah.
And brilliant. And, you know, sadly, she was one of the celebrities.
2016 victims. Yeah,
that's right. One of the many celebrities we lost last year, the terrible year of 2016, when we lost so many great people, including Victoria Wood and David Bowie and numerous other people. Who's the poet? The Canadian poet?
Yeah, Leonard
Cohen. Yeah. And a whole bunch of other people.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So those are the two people who would join you in the bookshop. Now, because all the books that come into the Oxfam bookshop are all donated by people, they're all secondhand books.
Yeah.
I expect you often find the same books coming in. What's the most common book that you receive at the Oxfam bookshop?
Well, it used to be Dan Brown, of course. That's a bit of a joke in second-hand bookshop circles.
What, the Da Vinci Code?
The Da Vinci Code, because it was so popular for so, you know, at a certain time, and everybody had a copy, read it, and either thought it was rubbish or absolutely loved it, and then eventually got rid of it. So we have had hundreds of Da Vinci Codes. We don't get so many now, but we do get quite a lot of general fiction, modern novels and classic novels. We get a lot of cookbooks, you know, cookbooks that are linked to particular television shows like Jamie Oliver and people like that.
Bake Off.
And Bake Off. So that when the show is popular, people go out and buy the books and then a year or so later realise they never use them and donate them to the shop. So we get loads of Jamie Oliver. Uh-huh. And we get a lot of celebrity biographies and autobiographies.
Yeah.
Which, again, are very popular for a short period of time and then nobody wants them.
I see.
But we're very lucky where we are because we get very good donations, quite a variety of stuff and some quite good ones.
Okay. I was going to ask you another question from a listener in the comments section. This question is from Marta, another regular in the comments section.
Hello, Marta.
And Marta asks you, do you have any recommendations of some interesting books or films or movies which you have read or watched recently? We'll start with the books. So Marta would like to know if you've got any book recommendations.
Well, the books I've been reading lately have been very much influenced by the backlisted podcast I mentioned before. So a lot of them are quite obscure. For instance, the last one I read is called The Citadel by A.J. Cronin, which was written in the 1930s. And I read it when I was a teenager, and I've always remembered it. And I managed to get a copy. It's out of print now, but I managed to get a copy on the internet and read it recently. And, I loved it when I was a teenager. I've always remembered it. And I loved it almost as much, if not more, this time, reading it the second time. It's about a very idealistic doctor, GP, in the 1920s, before the start of the health service. Mm. And it's brilliant.
What's so brilliant about it?
Well, it's very interesting because you learn something about the way people were looked after medically before we had the health service. Because the whole of my lifetime, we've had the health service.
Yeah.
But in those days, doctors were paid per visit or per consultation. There was quite a lot of corruption with doctors charging for giving medicines that were just boiled water or something. And, you know, there wasn't the same regulation that there is today. Mm. And a lot of the illnesses, of course, were caused by infrastructure. You know, the fact that the sewers or the weren't properly, you know, they weren't put in everywhere, and the water supply wasn't pure. Mm. So people died of all sorts of, you know, enteric diseases to do with, you know, typhoid.
Cholera.
Yes, all the things that are spread by bad water.
Yeah.
In the book, he and one of his fellow doctors are so frustrated because they keep having people dying from these illnesses, entirely preventable,
yeah,
preventable, but not very easily treated, that they go and find the sewer that is leaking and making the water poisonous,
yeah,
and they blow it up so that the authorities have to replace it.
How do they blow it up? With a bomb.
Sticks of dynamite.
Oh my God.
But it's really the story about this young man who starts out being incredibly idealistic and wanting to improve things, and he gradually gets worn down by the system and ends up being one of these quacks who just gets as much money, gets himself popular with people with lots of money, yeah, and then charges, treats them for conditions they haven't really got and all that sort of thing, until he's finally brought up short and realizes what he's doing, and then goes back to his more humanitarian way of working.
Right.
It's just very interesting. It's quite moving as well.
Mm.
But it's very interesting learning about the system and the things that went on.
Yeah,
they did things in those days.
I suppose there's this character arc as well of this guy who starts out, yeah, idealistic and then becomes cynical and then goes back to
He doesn't get cynical. He gets seduced by the money and the position and everything that he can command.
Right, I see. Does it tell you something about like healthcare today, in a sense?
Yes, it does. There's lots of parallels. But a lot of it is about morals, and it's a very socialist book, really, I suppose. It espouses socialist ideals.
The idea of, state healthcare, basically.
Mm-hmm.
A regulated healthcare system.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But it's a wonderful story as well.
Yeah. The thing is, though, that my listeners might not be able to get a copy of that.
No. Well, this is the trouble. I suddenly realised that when I was thinking about the books, that a lot of them are, because of being influenced by the backlisted podcast,
yeah,
most of them are a bit obscure. Right. The one that I've read recently, which is modern, which has recently been published, is called Mothering Sunday by Graham Swift.
Uh-huh.
He's a wonderful writer. He wrote, many years ago, he wrote Waterland. Don't know. It's a very famous book of his.
I don't know
if people might know that.
I think I've heard of it, but I haven't read it.
But this one is very short. It's a novella, really, which means a very short novel.
Okay.
And it's about events happening on one day, which happens to be Mothering Sunday, in just after the First World War. And it's a tiny book, but it contains a heck of a lot, because it's about class and it's about post-traumatic stress after the First World War. It's about families losing sons. It's just very good.
Okay.
Very, very good.
All right.
I was most impressed with that.
That's Mothering Sunday by Graham Swift.
Swift.
And the fact that it's a novella,
yeah,
is a good thing for my listeners, because it just makes it a bit more achievable. Because, you know, it can be quite hard. If English isn't your first language, or if you're reading in a second language, it, yeah, can be a bit of a slog sometimes,
yes,
to keep going.
I'm sure.
So a shorter book is ideal.
Yeah. Well, Mothering Sunday is one of those books. It's like a diamond, you know, it's been compressed. Mm. So that there's, it's a very small thing, but there's a heck of a lot in it.
It's a bit like The Old Man and the Sea.
Yeah.
That's a short book, but yes. it's very, very efficiently written.
Yes, that's right.
And it's a very simple story. Mm. It's like there's an old man. He goes out to catch a fish. He catches it and then he tries to bring it back. And, you know, and it's like a big epic sort of metaphor for something.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. It's not just about catching a fish.
It's not about catching a fish. If Mark, I can just imagine what Mark Kermode would say.
Right. The other one that he always talks about, or that he famously talked about in those terms, was Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Oh, yes.
Which is a sort of espionage thriller.
Yeah.
And he said it's not really about spies. It's not really about spying. It's about, I don't know, truth and trust and and larger themes like that.
Well, but you'll find that most really good books are like that, aren't they? They're not just about what they appear on the surface.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. That's what I always think. Yeah. Mm. And that's one of the joys of, well, either books or films. I'm more of a film person.
Yes, you are these days. You did read a lot at one time, didn't you?
Yeah. I think that I've got so many books all around me, loads of them, the piles of books that I really want to read, but somehow it has slipped out of my lifestyle. And I am now a podcast person. And so I have loads of podcasts in my phone that I listen to, not just Mark and Simon's film review, but also Adam Buxton's podcast.
Oh, yes, that's another of my favourites. I like him very much. Well, it depends on who he's talking to. I love it when he's talking to Louis Theroux.
Yeah.
They're another pair that are just sympathetic to each other. They go together really well and they talk really well together.
Yeah. I mean, Adam, I just always enjoy listening to his podcast. But yeah, I agree with you completely. When Louis Theroux is on there, that's brilliant. But I just think Louis Theroux is probably one of my favourite people.
Yeah, same here. I think he's extraordinary.
And I keep mentioning him every now and then on this podcast, but I don't think I've quite got the message through yet.
Right.
So my audience, that they probably don't know how to spell Louis Theroux.
Yeah.
It's spelled L-O-U-I-S, Theroux, T-H-E-R-O-U-X.
Yes.
T-H-E-R-O-U-X, Louis Theroux. He's a documentary filmmaker, basically. And he makes these interesting documentaries. How would you describe his work?
Tricky. People say that he is faux naive, which means that he comes across as being someone who's an innocent. He doesn't really understand what the situation is, and so he has to ask questions in order to find out what's going on. I mean, I would have said that was a fair enough description of his style.
I agree. He looks a bit sort of dorky.
Goofy. Possibly.
Geeky. He's kind of a bit tall, a bit sort of
Gangly,
like he's kind of a bit too big for his bone. Big for his what?
Well, his arms and legs are very long. He's just a very long, tall person.
And he's sort of got this awkward Britishness. And he wears glasses and he's kind of, I mean, from, as he says himself, from certain angles, he can look quite handsome. But then from other angles, he looks really sort of, his nose looks too big and he wears these big glasses. And
I think he looks handsome all the time.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Do you fancy him?
That would be a bit much, wouldn't it?
Well,
fancying him.
You just said that.
Well, of course I don't fancy him. I'm an old woman and he's a young man.
You can fancy him, can't you?
Well, I think he's very attractive. Just leave it at that.
I think that means you fancy him. and he's got this way of speaking. And you're right. He gives the impression of being a little bit sort of naive. And he goes into these... He's a journalist who ends up in the middle of the stories that he's reporting on. And he started out by sort of investigating weird people
Louis Theroux's Weird Weekends.
That was the TV show that he used to present, Louis Theroux's Weird Weekends. And he would, a lot of them would be in the United States, and he'd go and sort of spend time with conspiracy theorists and neo-Nazis and all sorts of weird fringe groups. And he'd go in, and he was very, he's very unassuming. Which means that he gives the impression that he's not judging the people he's talking to. He's actually very friendly, and his naive, awkward English friendliness is very disarming for the people he's talking to. And he poses no threat to them. And, you know, he doesn't have an aggressive style. He's actually very friendly and very nice. And as a result, people kind of open up to him in ways that they wouldn't open up to other investigative reporters. And as a result, he gets amazing reactions from the people he's talking to.
I think political interviewers and reporters could take a lot of notes from him.
Mm-hmm.
That,
yeah.
You know, you don't get the best out of people by being aggressive.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm just trying to think of a good example of this. Like, he went to South Africa and he spoke to this guy called Eugene Terreblanche.
Yes.
Who is, I mean, I don't
know. White supremacist.
A white supremacist in South Africa. And Louis, it's actually hilarious to watch the video because Louis is going, okay, so, you know, I'd just like to get an idea of where exactly it is you stand on this. And so, you know, I've just come up with a list, and I just want to know if you think these things are okay or not. And like the first thing is like, so a white person and a black person going out on a date. And Eugene Terreblanche is absolutely not. I don't know. I can't. It's really hard to explain.
It is.
You have to just see it. Yeah. But yeah, people could maybe look on YouTube for Louis Theroux and look at his documentaries. But he is often a guest on Adam Buxton's podcast.
Because they went to school together and they know each other very well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And yeah, they complement each other very well.
Yeah, they do.
So I was saying that I listen to lots of podcasts, Mark and Simon's podcast, Adam Buxton's podcast, the word ramble. That's it. Remember, I said that. Yeah. I'd come back to that one. On Adam's podcast, he talks about his conversations he describes them as ramble chats. So I think my listeners know what ramble means because, I mean, I've done it enough.
They should do if they listen to you.
So, yeah, that's why I don't end up reading so much. I just end up listening to all these interesting podcasts that people keep uploading.
Well, what you should do in that case is read Andy Miller, who I was talking about before, who does the Backlisted podcast.
Yeah.
He's written a book called The Year of Reading Dangerously.
Yeah.
Because he found that he was in your situation, having, even though he was working in the book trade and he had to read certain things as part of his job, but he lost the knack of being able to read for pleasure. So he started a sort of regime, a program of getting himself back into reading. And it's you know, that's what the book's all about the books that he reads and how he goes about it. And it's really brilliantly written, and it's great.
Okay.
I've lent it to your father to read because he's also not very good at getting into reading, which I think is a real shame.
Why? What's his story then with reading?
Oh, I don't know. I think he finds it hard to concentrate on reading. He's very good at concentrating on work and that sort of thing, but I think he finds it hard to sort of lose himself in a book. Certain ones I've recommended to him he's really enjoyed and has got into them, but I know he finds it difficult.
But you lent him The Year of Reading Dangerously, and has it worked?
I don't know, because I only gave it to him recently. I gave it to him to take, you know, he's been in Brussels for the last couple of days working, and so I gave it to him to read on the plane and while waiting for things. So I don't know whether he's been reading it. I'll find out later this afternoon when I go and pick him up from the airport.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, I should get a copy of that. Maybe that will sort of get me started on reading again. I mean, I did read on holiday. What was I reading? Oh, I can't remember. I was reading a book by Steve Earle. Do you know who he is?
I know the name. I can't think who he is.
Steve Earle's a country musician from the United States.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Who had a very interesting life and a real up and down musical career. Because he, as well as being a fantastic musician and a really great songwriter, he writes these sorts of story songs. You know those songs in the country tradition?
Yes, yeah.
Where it's a you know, each verse of the song is a you know, a different part of the story.
Yes.
And the chorus kind of wraps the whole thing up. I mean, it's really good stuff.
Yeah.
He started writing as well, and he kind of does the same thing in his stories as he does in his songs, like these stories about people on the wrong side of the tracks. You know, there's stories of people who are involved in lives of crime or people who are caught up in drug addiction. Mm-hmm. And yet there's a strong thread of sort of romance and tragedy and, oh, it's hard to explain, really. Mm. And I read one of his books, and I did lose myself in that. That was interesting.
Mm.
It was all about a doctor in the 1960s who was a junkie.
Mm.
And who was kind of living in this one horse town on the run, you know, because of his lifestyle.
Mm.
And every time he took his heroin, he would be visited by the ghost of Hank Williams. Hank Williams, the country singer.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it's an interesting device.
Yes.
Because it's sort of. In the story, the main character was Hank Williams's doctor.
Mm.
And I don't know if you know about Hank Williams, but apparently he was addicted to painkilling medication.
Mm.
I think so. There are some elements of truth in the story.
Mm.
And, you know, it's a sort of a redemptive tale. You know, a tale of redemption, yeah, which is often what these Western stories are, either about revenge or about redemption or both. And this one is a tale of redemption about a guy who you know, you think that he's lost and that he's going to die because he's at the end of the line, you know, in terms of his life. And he's really badly messed up on heroin, but he manages to kind of get himself back on his feet in various ways, and you know, that sort of thing.
Talking of which,
yes,
talking of films, which we haven't done, but you did mention films earlier on.
Yeah, Marta asked for a movie recommendation.
Oh, right, yeah. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I read last night, I watched Trainspotting 2.
Ah,
which James lent me, and James said it was really good.
Yes,
and have you seen it?
I have seen it.
I thought it was amazing.
Mm.
I thought it was really good. Did you?
Oh, yeah. I actually preferred it to the original.
It was incredible. I mean, I loved the structure of it, you know, that it turns out that Spud wrote the story of Trainspotting 1.
We should watch out for spoilers here.
Sorry.
That's okay. That's not...
But
that's,
I was completely wrapped up in it. I thought it was amazing, and I was... you know, laughing and crying, and I thought it was very emotional.
Yeah.
And I was just so glad that this probably is a spoiler, but I don't care.
Yeah.
But I was really glad that Spud is okay, because I was very worried about him.
You were worried about him in the original film?
Both. Well, and particularly in the second one.
Right.
I thought that he was the one that was going to be utterly doomed, but quite the reverse, really.
Mm. So I don't know if my listeners all have seen the film. A lot of people will know Trainspotting, and they'll know Trainspotting 2. I know, for example, I think that Marta, the listener who wrote that question, I think she's seen it. I think someone asked me to talk about it on the podcast. And I suppose I'm doing that right now. But anyway, for those people who aren't so familiar with it, what is Trainspotting and what is Trainspotting 2? Do you want to start with what is Trainspotting?
Well, it's a while since I saw it, but it's a story of four young men from Edinburgh
who are all five,
because one of them dies.
Yes.
Yeah. But he's not such a big character, is he, in the thing?
Well,
not that I remember, anyway.
Well, he is in the first one, and I think his passing is his death. Let's call it what it is.
Yeah.
His death is a sort of looming presence in the second film. don't you think?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. Anyway, they're all addicted to heroin, basically. And that's really grim. But the film was made by...
What's his name? What's his name?
You know, Hoojamaa Flip.
What do you call him? Yeah, the guy who did the Olympics.
Yes.
The guy who did 127 hours. The guy who did...
Can you not remember?
I keep thinking Irvin Welsh, but he wrote the book.
No, he wrote
Danny
the book.
Boyle. Danny Boyle. Oh, Danny it. Boyle.
Anyway, it's done in his amazing style. Just very, I don't know how you describe it, very in your face, isn't it?
It's
intense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Visceral.
Yeah, and colourful and, yeah, all those things.
It's like you really experience the film. It's a bit of a rush. It's a bit of an adrenaline rush. I say adrenaline. I mean, the story's about certainly the first film was about heroin addicts. So there is something sort of chemical about the experience of watching his films.
The pictures that kind of match the subject matter somehow.
Yeah, it's intense. Yeah, his work is often intense.
Like, very intense.
Like the most intense one for me was 127 Hours, which is the story of the guy who has to cut off his own arm in order to survive a climbing accident. Oh, wow, that was really intense.
Oh, it was, yeah.
Yeah, but Trainspotting was, this intense
story.
I
found this one, T2, I found it even more intense because I cared about the characters. I even cared about Begbie by the end.
Begbie
by the end.
Yeah.
You almost felt sorry for him at the end.
Yeah, that's right. It's really clever the way that they avoided just turning him into a monster.
Yeah.
Every character was given a certain amount of backstory.
Yeah.
Not, you know, some of them were good. Some, you know, they all had bits of bad in them.
Because it showed how nothing ever comes from nothing. You know, Begbie wasn't bad because he was bad. He was bad because of the way his father was and, you know, his upbringing and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And
there's no such thing as just a straightforward evil person. There's always a reason for it.
The film Trainspotting and the sequel, they both star Ewan McGregor.
Hmm.
I don't know if I'm still not sure if all my listeners know which film we're talking about. You see, Ewan McGregor film, his character, what's his name again?
Renton, Mark Renton.
Yeah. So the first film ends with him doing something questionable on a moral level, like he does something which the other characters, you know, it's a sort of a betrayal. At the end of his friends, and then this film sees him come back to see his friends, and he, you know, to an extent, Renton is sort of he's done some bad things. They've all done really bad things. You see,
they have. They've done some dreadful things.
Yeah, and yet the film kind of tries to explore the context in which they do those things, and it treats people with a sort of level of human respect. It's got it. The ending is, I suppose, quite positive.
Yes, it is. But having said that, I was streaming with tears by the end of it.
Were you really?
Oh yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. As you said, you know, you really live it. I mean, because it's so intense.
Yeah.
I thought it was amazing.
Yeah.
And after I'd watched it, I tweeted James and told him I'd watched it, and so we then had this quite long conversation over text. We had a long conversation over text about it, which was nice.
He
who lent me the film, the DVD, I didn't see it at the cinema. In fact, I didn't think I could cope with seeing it at the cinema. It would just be too much,
really. Yeah, very intense experience. If you care about the characters,
yeah.
One thing that my listeners might notice when they're watching that is that the whole thing is set in Edinburgh.
Might be very difficult for them to understand, because it was difficult for me to understand on occasions.
Yeah, because they speak with very strong accents. Certainly in the first film. I mean, that's one of the features of the film and the book. I don't know if you've ever read the book.
No, because I hate books that write speech in dialect. I find it really irritating.
Yeah, well, the book Trainspotting by Irvin Welsh is written in the dialect. I mean, for example, it's written phonetically. So the way that the local characters speak is actually spelled out. It's hard to explain that, but the spelling is different and the whole thing's written in this strong accent. So it must be really, really hard for learners of English to understand that.
In fact, it's not really the right sort of thing we should be discussing, is it? If you're talking to people who are learning English as a foreign language.
Well, I don't know, Mum. I mean, you know, they should be aware of that kind of English too, shouldn't
they?
Yes,
but having said that, you know, that Edinburgh accent is so strong. As I say, in fact, at one point I considered putting the subtitles on because I couldn't understand some of it.
I think
you get your ear in. At the beginning I found it difficult, but by the end I was managing all right.
Yeah, you get used to it. But yeah. I certainly think for my listeners, if they wanted to watch it in the original version, you know, in English, then they would definitely need to put the subtitles on.
I think so, yeah.
As we know, if you're using films to learn English or learn any language, that there are various things you can do. You can watch it with the subtitles in your language so that you make sure you understand it properly, and then you watch it again with the subtitles in English, and then you watch it again with no subtitles. You know, there's various ways you can play around with the subtitles and stuff to help with the learning process. But just in terms of recommending a really good film, then that would be, your recommendation. Recommendation here.
I was very impressed with it.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. Mum, I've got loads of other questions.
And I'm saying that the time is getting on and I think we really ought to draw it to a close.
I agree.
I've got various things I need to do now.
Yeah. And is it raining? Is it pissing down with rain yet?
No, it's just very, very cloudy and looks as though it might, but it hasn't done, so that's good.
Okay. I was just going to say, I've got loads of other questions, but yeah, we've run out of time.
Yeah, I'm afraid we have.
So
it's been nice to have a chat, though.
It has been, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I could talk to you for ages and ages. And to an extent, the fact that I have this podcast kind of gives me an excuse to have these extended conversations.
Well, it's difficult sometimes to have long conversations, isn't it? Because when we get together, for example, there's always so much going on
all the time. There's like other people around and lots of other things that need to be done. Yeah, yeah, it can be hard to find the time to have a long conversation with someone.
Yeah.
But that's kind of one of the advantages of doing this podcast.
Yeah.
That as well as creating some content which I can publish and help people to learn English by listening to genuine conversations, and they can get little tips and recommendations about books and films and things. Also, it gives me an opportunity to have an extended conversation with someone.
Yes.
In this case, you, which is very nice.
Yeah. Lovely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, maybe we can do this again sometime.
Yeah. Okay. That would be good.
All right, then. And you're going to go and pick up Dad from the airport.
I am. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you can tell him from me that, you know, I haven't had him on the podcast talking about politics lately.
Okay.
I mean, but if he's still interested, he could come back and we can catch up on the whole Brexit situation.
Oh, no.
I know.
It's a tragedy. The whole thing is just awful.
Yeah, well, if he can stand talking about it.
The trouble is, the more we talk about it, the more depressed we become.
I know, yeah. I know. Well, you can just let him know that he's always welcome.
I'm sure he'd be very happy to talk to you. He's always happy to talk to you.
Yeah,
so.
Well, he's always welcome. And, you know, I'm sure my listeners have been, you know, waiting to hear from him as well. Yeah. But I will speak on behalf of everybody and say thank you very much for coming on the podcast, Mum.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, thank you for talking so generously to us. Yeah, it's been very nice.
Good.
Okay.
All right, well, take care.
Will do. And
Speak to you again soon.
Okay, then.
Yeah.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Right then. So I hope you enjoyed listening to that chat with my mum, who's lovely, isn't she? I'm very lucky to have a mum like my mum because she's really nice. Anyway, without going on about that too much, I hope you enjoyed listening to the second part of our rambling conversation. Now, how much vocabulary did you identify? How much did you notice? How much stuff did you understand? Now, I predict that you understood quite a lot of my conversation with mum. That's just my sort of professional opinion. That's a prediction. I think you probably did okay. You probably followed the conversation without too much difficulty, just because she speaks clearly, doesn't she? She's not too difficult to follow. And she was recorded quite well using the microphone that I gave to my dad. So she was using my dad's microphone. So it was well recorded and she speaks clearly. So I think you probably understood most of it. But I also think that there's probably quite a lot of vocabulary in there that you probably didn't know or that you don't even realize that you missed. There might be some words or phrases that you already know, but you're not completely sure about. Let me go through it now. This is the learning opportunity here, okay? Because after all, Luke's English Podcast is a podcast for people who are learning English. And the idea is that, you know, by listening to authentic conversations, by getting exposure to natural English, that you can pick up the language like that, or you can at least kind of get used to listening to it. But I also think that giving you a bit of support is vital in the process. I think it can really help and really make a difference to your English. So not only do you listen to conversations and hopefully enjoy doing it, but also sometimes it's worth me just sort of giving you a bit of support and going through some of the language and sort of flagging a few things up, going, look, did you notice that? How about this? Did you see that? What about this phrase? Do you know this phrase? That's what it means. That's the difference between this and this. You know, that's my, it's my job, isn't it? It's my job as a teacher to do all that stuff. Okay, so let me go through some words and phrases from that conversation and let's see if you can add this language to your vocabulary too. Okay, all of this stuff, you can see all of this on the page for the episode on my website. I recommend that you check it out because it will help as well. Okay, right, so I'm going to read out some phrases that were said in that conversation and then highlight some of the language. So the first thing I'm going to read out is this. My mum talking about the shop, she said, "We're proud of our shop, we take a great pride in it." So you know the expression to be proud of something. Also, we can say to take pride in something, to take pride in something. Actually, my mum said to take a pride. In fact, to take a great pride in something. Honestly, I think it's more common to say just to take pride in something or to take great pride in something rather than to take a great pride in something. Okay, so I think it would be, you know, we're really proud of our shop. We take great pride in it, even though my mum actually said we take a great pride in it. Okay, think about your situation. Whenever you come across language that you want to add to your own English, you need to try and make a little sentence about yourself using the phrase. So, what do you take pride in? What are you proud of? What about in your town or city? Is there something you're particularly proud of? What do you take great pride in? Is there something you take great pride in doing in your life? Think about it and maybe come up with a sentence or two. Let's see. So in the bookshop where my mum works, they don't sell new books. They sell old books, which have been donated by people in the community. So these are second-hand books or used books. Okay, so there you go. Just two phrases for things that are not new. You can say second-hand or used. Okay, do you have any second-hand things in your home? Do you have any second-hand clothes? Do you have any second-hand books? Do you have a second-hand bookshop in your town? What do you think? Do you like to get second-hand books or do you prefer to get new books? I like to get second-hand books, I think, because usually second-hand books feel like they've got a history. Sometimes in second-hand books, you can see little notes that have been written. Maybe if they were offered as a gift and you kind of, you know, you read a little note like to Arthur, you know, with lots of love from Ethel. And you're like, oh, who were Arthur and Ethel? Yeah, anyway, secondhand. Okay. Another phrase was, we get a lot of cookbooks. So a cookbook, well, it's pretty clear, isn't it, what a cookbook is? A cookbook is a book with lots of recipes in it. Okay, so if you want to learn how to cook some stuff, you need to get a cookbook. Or you could just look on the internet, but cookbooks are very popular. Okay, how do you have any cookbooks in your home? How many cookbooks do you have? Downstairs in our flat, we've got a little shelf in the kitchen with loads of cookbooks in it that we never use. I don't know why we never use them. There are some really good cookbooks in there with some great recipes in them, but the only one I use is the one that my mum gave to me at Christmas a couple of years ago, and it's got her recipes in it. So it's a homemade cookbook with some of my mum's recipes. Some of you will have heard an episode of this podcast when I actually cooked one of my mum's recipes on the podcast, and I talked about the recipe, and I talked about the way I was preparing the food while I was preparing it in the kitchen. I think that one is called Cooking with Luke. Verbs and phrases for the kitchen. I think that's what it was called. You can find it in the episode archive. So that's cookbooks. Then again, other types of books. We have biographies and autobiographies. So in the secondhand bookshop where my mum works, they get lots of celebrity biographies and autobiographies. What's the difference between a biography and an autobiography? Okay, well, a biography is the story of someone's life, but it's written by someone else. Okay, the story of someone's life written by someone else. I'm just looking around the room here to see if I've got any. I don't. I don't have any to use as an example. Do I? No, nothing around here. Oh, I've got one here. Okay, here's an example. This book in my hand is called Fab, An Intimate Life of Paul McCartney by Howard Souness. So this is a biography of Paul McCartney, not written by Paul, but written by someone else, Howard Souness. So that's a biography, okay? And then an autobiography means it's written by the person, okay? So I've got an autobiography up there on the shelf. I've got a book by Richard Pryor about his own life, and it was written by Richard Pryor. So that's an autobiography, okay? Okay, then biography written by someone else, autobiography written by the person, him or herself. Okay, another phrase from the episode was, a lot of books I've been reading are quite obscure. That's what my mum said. She said, a lot of the books I've been reading are quite obscure. So if something is obscure, that's O-B-S-C-U-R-E, it means it's only known by a few people. So not widely known, just known by a few people. So some of the books that my mum has been reading are quite obscure because they come from they're recommendations from this podcast that she likes, the backlisted podcast. And the backlisted podcast, as you'll know, if you listen to part one of this, features books that have gone out of print. So that's why a lot of the books she's reading are quite obscure, so not known by that many people. For example, the book The Citadel by A.J. Cronin, which is the book she was talking about this doctor who, I can't remember when the book was set, but it was a book about a doctor. One of the phrases she used to describe the story of it was this. She said, a lot of the problems were caused by infrastructure, like the sewers. So the problems that they experienced at the time that the book is set, a lot of the medical problems were caused by infrastructure, like the sewers. So let's start with the word infrastructure. So it's infra. There's a r sound in there. It's not infra, not like, yeah, it's not infrastructure, but infrastructure. Infrastructure is really the basic facilities in a town or city or in a country, such as the transport, the communications, the power supplies, the buildings, the roads, and the sanitation systems which enable that place to function. So this is infrastructure, okay? And that includes the sewers. And the sewers are the underground tunnels that carry all the toilet waste And by toilet waste, I mean all the piss and shit. So sewers are disgusting places, usually underground, under the city, under the town, and they carry away all of the poo and all the pee from people's toilets. So when you flush the toilet, all that waste goes down into the sewers and then is sort of carried away somewhere else. So those are the sewers, okay? So back in the olden days, a lot of health problems were caused by bad sewer systems that wouldn't remove the waste properly, and the water supply would end up getting contaminated, which would lead to lots of enteric diseases. So here's the next phrase. Enteric diseases. Well, we know what diseases are, but what does enteric mean? Well, an enteric disease is one which has been caused by unclean water, okay? Enteric diseases. For example, typhoid, cholera, and diarrhea as well. Lovely. Lovely stuff. All right, let's move on away from enteric diseases and sewers and things, because that's just disgusting, isn't it? So next we have the phrase entirely preventable diseases, but not easily treated. So these enteric diseases, oh, we're still on enteric diseases. Okay. They're entirely preventable, but not easily treated. So I wanted to look at the expressions to prevent a disease, to treat something, and to cure something or someone. Okay, so to prevent a disease means to make sure that that disease never infects people in the first place, that to make sure that the disease never really happens. That's to prevent it. To treat someone or to treat a disease would mean to give treatment to people who are suffering from a disease. So you can treat a person, for example, you know, treat a person suffering from typhoid, or you can treat the disease as well. Like, you know, we need to look into ways of treating typhoid, let's say, and also to cure as well. So to cure means to make a disease disappear completely, okay? To make a disease disappear completely through treatment, okay? Now, they say that prevention is better than cure, because it's better to make sure that the disease never even happens than it is to, like, treat it and then make it go away, like treat it and then cure it completely. Okay, prevention is better than cure. Okay, so let's say even if you can't prevent a disease, you can treat the person who's got it and then hopefully cure that person of that disease. Okay, and also the noun, we have the noun cure as well. Okay, the cure for something, like for example, scientists are still looking for the cure for cancer. Another phrase from the episode, they find the sewer and they blow it up so that the authorities have to replace it. Talking about the plot of that book still in the story, they find the sewer and they blow it up. So to blow something up means to make something explode. How did they blow it up? With a bomb? No, with some sticks of dynamite. So obviously you know what a bomb is. Let me just remind you that you don't pronounce the B, so it's bomb. Not bomb, and that's an explosive device. Sticks of dynamite are also types of explosive device. These are things that look a bit like candles in a weird way. They look a bit like candles, but they explode. So they're like bad candles, if you like. They're kind of like candles, but they explode because they're made of nitroglycerine, not wax. And they have a fuse at the top, not a wick. On a candle, it's a wick. But on sticks of dynamite, they have a fuse. And you light the fuse. And there's nothing you can do. There's no way you can stop the fuse. Like, as you know from films and cartoons, you light the fuse. And eventually, when the fuse reaches the stick of dynamite, then bang, you know, it explodes. Okay, so that's a stick of dynamite. Here's a long sentence from the conversation like this. It starts out with this man who starts out being incredibly idealistic and wanting to improve things, and he gradually gets worn down by the system and ends up becoming one of these quacks who gets himself popular with people who have lots of money and treats them for things that they haven't really got before he's finally brought up short. So not lots of nice language in there. To start out is basically to start, but to start from the very beginning. So to start from the very beginning of a process would be to start out. In this case, we're talking about the man's career. He starts out being incredibly idealistic. If you are idealistic, it means that you base your behavior on certain high ideals or principles, even if it's impractical or unrealistic. It's a bit similar to being naive, I guess. Like, people say that if you're idealistic, it means you're a bit naive because you're not really realistic. You're just basing everything on these high principles to be idealistic. To get worn down by something means to become weaker because of difficult experiences over time. Now, there's the literal meaning of to get worn down. Like, for example, let's say the tires on your car, eventually, because of all of the, what's the word for it? Because they get worn, because of the wear, the way that the tires have contact with the road, and eventually the road, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Erode, that's it. The friction of the tire on the road will erode the tires and wear them away, so that eventually you end up with bald tires. You know, the rubber is just worn down. So that's the literal meaning of to get worn down by something. But we also use it in a more idiomatic sense, meaning to become weaker because of difficult experiences. So if you start out as a very idealistic doctor going, yeah, I'm going to cure everyone and I'm going to, you know, make this town really healthy, but over time you come up against difficulties like maybe political situations in the town or the lack of education, and, you know, time and time again, more and more difficulties, eventually your strength and your motivation could be worn down by the kind of difficulties that you come up against. Okay. And in the story, the guy becomes a quack. So a quack is basically a fake doctor, a fraudulent doctor, you know, the sort of doctor who would probably just do things for money rather than genuinely trying to help people. So he becomes a bit more cynical and he becomes a quack. Okay, Q-U-A-C-K, exactly the same word as the noise that a duck makes. Quack, 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 quack. Ducks also go quack, but a quack, in terms of doctors, that's like a fake doctor. Okay, the next phrase from that paragraph is to bring someone up short. So he becomes a quack who gets himself popular with people who have lots of money, and he treats them for things that they haven't really got before he's finally brought up short. To be brought up short means to suddenly stop doing something, or to be stopped by something, often with a surprise. So some sort of surprising experience stops you. It brings you up short, and it can be passive or active. So this event brought him up short, or he was brought up short. I think this means that he had some sort of experience which changed him. It stopped him in his cynical ways and meant that he kind of he became an honest doctor again, because something brought him up short. Something interrupted him and stopped him. Okay. She said, it's quite moving. She said, my mum said, the book is quite moving. So if something's moving, it means it makes you feel a strong emotion. So, you know, what about you? When was the last time you read a moving book or a moving story? When was the last time you saw a moving film? When was the last time you were moved by something like a book or a film? I wonder which book or film it was. The next thing is, there is this character arc of this guy who starts out innocent and gets seduced by the money. So a character arc spelled A-R-C. And an arc, in this case, means a narrative or storyline for a particular character which changes from the start to the finish. So when we're talking about films or books, we talk about character arcs, meaning the storyline for that particular character, how they go through various changes from the beginning to the end of the book. Okay, in most movies, the principal character goes through some sort of character arc where they, you know, change in some way throughout the story. Okay, like, for example, in Star Wars, Luke Skywalker starts out as this young farm boy, just a kid who works on a farm, and then he goes through all these changes, and by the end he becomes like this powerful Jedi Knight. I'm quite curious to see the development of Luke Skywalker's character arc in the new Star Wars film, which is coming out in a couple of months. I can't wait, because I'm a Star Wars geek. I don't know about you. Next phrase is, there's lots of parallels with today. So we'll start with the vocabulary in that sentence. There's lots of parallels with today. Parallels just means similarities, okay? Now we have parallel lines. Parallel lines are lines that never cross or never deviate from each other. Like, for example, train tracks. The two tracks on for a train, they're parallel. They never deviate, they never go away from each other, and they never cross each other. They're parallel. So that's parallel lines, but we also talk about parallels with something. So in the book, there are parallels with today, meaning similarities. Now, the grammar there, my mum actually said, there's lots of parallels with today. Now, the observant kind of grammar people out there might have noticed that technically that is grammatically wrong. So that it should be, there are lots of parallels. Now, my mum, if she's listening to this, she will be kicking herself, because she values correct grammar. And I think she would like to be someone who always uses quote unquote correct grammar. But this is the sort of thing that many, many native speakers do every day. There's meaning there is, when in fact it should be there are. For example, there's lots of parallels. There's lots of people in the room. There's lots of cars in the street, for example. So there is lots of plus a plural. Technically, that should be there are lots of people. There are lots of cars. But when you contract the there with a verb be, when you contract it, it's so much easier to say there's than it is to say there are lots of parallels. It's a little harder to say that than there's a lot of parallels. That's probably the reason. But anyway, regardless of that, it is technically incorrect, but everyone does it without even realizing they're doing it. So I think it's sort of an exception that's generally considered to be okay, even though most people don't even realize they're doing it. And if they did realize they were doing that, they would probably kick themselves. So I guess that's a good mistake, if you know what I mean. There are good mistakes and bad mistakes. Bad mistakes would be ones that nobody does, ones that are obviously wrong. And then good mistakes are the sorts of things that native speakers make. I know that sounds unfair, but there it is. What are you going to do? You could continue saying there are lots of people in the street. There are lots, or there are a lot of people in the street. You can continue doing that. Great. But it's interesting, isn't it, that so many native speakers these days say there's lots of people in the street and not many people notice. What else? My mum said about the book, she said it espouses socialist ideas. So to espouse something means to support it. Okay. Usually when we're talking about a way of life, to espouse socialist ideas in this case. Okay. Espouse. E-S-P-O-U-S-E. E-S-P-O-U-S-E. Or E-S-P-O-U-S-E-S. Spelling. Espouse or espouses. Then we went on to talk about the book Mothering Sunday by Graham Swift. My mum said that it's very short. It's a novella. So a novella is a short novel. She said it's a tiny book, but it contains a heck of a lot. A heck of a lot is quite a nice expression. It just means a lot. But it's emphasized with a heck of at the beginning. So you end up with a heck of a lot. Also, we have a hell of a lot as well. So you can say, it's difficult to say there are a lot. That's why people say there's a lot. There's a lot of people in the street. There's a heck of a lot of people in the street. There's a hell of a lot of people in the street. My mum said it's about class. It's about post-traumatic stress after the First World War. It's about families losing sons. Post-traumatic stress, or PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder. This is emotional distress or shock which continues in someone's life after experiencing extreme danger or stress. It's common in soldiers who've experienced the shock of combat in war. So you can imagine a soldier who's come back from the war, and they may have been exposed to situations of extreme danger, maybe explosions, you know, gunfire. They may have seen people getting killed. They may have killed people themselves. They may have been wounded in combat. People in those situations often come back and come out of danger, and yet they're still distressed. They're still experiencing shock. They're still experiencing the sort of after effects of moments of extreme stress. And that condition is called post-traumatic stress disorder. Next phrase is this one. I think I said, or my mum said, if English is your second language, it can be a bit of a slog sometimes to keep going. It can be a bit of a slog to keep reading. So a slog is the word, S-L-O-G. A slog means a long, difficult and tiring experience. A slog, you know. So, for example, you know, you could say, "Oh, we, you know, there's no subway station near our house because we live at the top of the hill. So we have to walk up the hill every day, and it's a bit of a slog, to be honest, especially when you're carrying heavy shopping bags. Or reading a long book in another language can be a bit of a slog because, you know, it's difficult to keep going because it's hard work. You have to." You know, you have to keep your motivation up. It's a bit of a slog sometimes. So reading can be a bit of a slog. It can be a long, difficult and tiring experience, which is why it's worth reading shorter books sometimes. Like, for example, The Old Man and the Sea by Ernest Hemingway. Let's see what else. We moved on to talk about the Adam Buxton podcast, especially episodes with Louis Theroux, who is one of our favourite people. Louis Theroux is that documentary filmmaker from the UK. And I always recommend that you watch his documentaries if you can find them, because they're very interesting. Louis Theroux. So my mum said that people say that he is faux naive. He comes across as innocent, so he has to ask questions to find out what's going on. So to be faux naive, faux is a French word that we use in English, F-A-U-X. Faux basically means fake or false. So he's not really naive, he's just sort of putting it on. He's pretending to be naive. Naive means innocent, you know, basically. Innocent meaning when you don't, when you are not cynical, probably because you are not very experienced. You know, you haven't had many bad experiences if you're naive. And so you expect things to be easy, or you expect everyone to be honest or kind. You have a kind of nice view of the world. Everything's fine. Everything's nice. Everything works out in the end. Happy, happy, happy. No, that's a bit naive. It's not very sort of tough or realistic a viewpoint on the world. So that's naive. So people seem to think that Louis Theroux is a bit naive, like he seems nice, he seems to just assume that everything's nice, he doesn't really realise how dark things are. He comes across as innocent, meaning he gives the impression of being sort of innocent, but in fact it's kind of an act. He's not that naive. He's putting it on in order to sort of get a certain reaction from people, to get people to explain things. It's just his sort of technique for getting information out of people. He just sort of pretends to not really know what's going on and to be innocent. He comes across as being a bit innocent, and as a result, people then they kind of don't feel defensive around him. They don't feel threatened by him, and they open up. And they kind of show him things and reveal certain things about themselves because they don't feel threatened by him. And it's all his method of kind of getting to the heart of a story. You have to see that his documentaries to understand what I'm talking about, really. If you can imagine someone walking into a situation like, for example, I don't know, like a bunch of neo-Nazis. Like, he might go and spend time with a bunch of right-wing neo-Nazis, and he's kind of all innocent and just sort of, you know, oh, so what do you believe in? Why do you believe in that then? And then they end up kind of telling him lots of things, and it's quite revealing in that sense. They don't feel like they're being attacked by him. Instead, he just goes in all open-minded, and they reveal sort of what they really believe in, which is quite interesting to watch in the form of a documentary. Words about his appearance. So here are some nice phrases about appearance. So Louis Theroux looks a bit dorky, goofy, or geeky. We also have the word gangly as well. All right then, so dorky, goofy, and geeky. All of these words are used to describe someone who is not cool. They're very similar words, but they're slightly different in meaning. So dorky means unfashionable, awkward, not socially relaxed or laid back, a bit uptight, and basically uncool. Okay, so imagine someone who doesn't wear the coolest clothes. Louis Theroux is an example. His haircut is, you know, he's not got the most fashionable haircut in the world. He looks a bit uncool, like he's got big glasses and he's got quite a big nose and a big chin. And he's just not the most cool, fashionable guy. He's a bit dorky. Okay. Another word is goofy. And goofy just means, if you would say someone is goofy if you thought they looked a bit ridiculous, mainly in appearance. You know, someone who's goofy might have teeth that are sticking out, or big glasses, or a big nose, or big ears, just kind of ridiculous looking features. You'd say that someone like that is goofy. You can think of the character Goofy from the Disney animations. You know, you've got Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse, his wife, and then his friend Goofy, who is like this sort of this dog with big teeth, and, you know, he's not as cool as Mickey Mouse. Because, yeah, Mickey Mouse is the coolest character in the world of Disney. Anyway, Goofy's kind of like a bit too tall, and he's got like these big teeth that stick out, and he's a bit awkward. He's goofy, okay? And then the word geeky as well. And if someone is geeky, you really mean that they're interested or obsessed by things like computers and comics and science fiction, that they're more interested in those things than they are in people. You know, a geek, the sort of person who would spend all their time in front of a computer in like a forum about Star Wars, discussing the finer details of, you know, Darth Vader's suit or something like that. That would be a geeky person. Now, actually, Louis Theroux isn't really a geek because he's very interested in people. He's actually very sociable. But he comes across as a bit geeky, probably just because of the way he looks, and maybe his sort of his English accent has something to do with it. I'm not sure. But anyway, he comes across as a bit of a geek. My mum said he's quite tall. He's a bit gangly. His arms and legs are very long. So gangly is a description of physical appearance, and it means someone who's tall and thin with an awkward appearance and a clumsy manner. Someone who's kind of very tall, they've got very long arms and legs, and they seem a bit clumsy. You could say someone like that is gangly. Okay. He's got this awkward Britishness. Now, awkward, this is a word that comes up a lot in my conversations, it seems. I often say that British people seem awkward. A-W-K-W-A-R-D. I often say that British people seem awkward, or that I felt awkward in a particular situation, or that a particular situation was awkward. Well, Louis Theroux can be described as having awkward Britishness, but what does awkward really mean? Well, it means kind of uncomfortable, not completely relaxed or loose, a bit embarrassing, a bit shy. So a situation can be awkward, and a person can be awkward as well. Okay, so what situation would be awkward? Well, let's say if you go to a nightclub, you're dancing in a nightclub, and then you notice that your boss is at the nightclub as well. You're like, oh God, what's my boss doing here? And you don't want your boss to see you sort of dancing in the nightclub. that would be a bit embarrassing. So you kind of, oh God, this is awkward. And you have to sort of hide in the corner of the room so that your boss doesn't see you. Is that a good example? Or let's say you go to a party and you don't realize it, but your ex-girlfriend is at the party as well. She's in the kitchen and you want to get a drink from the fridge in the kitchen. But if you go in there, you're going to end up seeing her. You'll have to talk to her. Oh, this is awkward. And especially since you're with another girl. Yeah, that's going to be awkward. All right. So I said my mum likes Louis Theroux and she thinks he's handsome or attractive. And I said, what, do you fancy him? So to fancy someone, this means to find someone physically attractive, probably in a sexual way. But this is the sort of word that teenagers use, you know, like to fancy. So, oh, do you fancy him? You know, like, oh, yeah, apparently he fancies your sister, you know, to fancy someone. To be attracted to someone. My mum or I said that Louis Theroux would spend time with all sorts of weird fringe groups. So fringe means the edge of something. And fringe groups are groups that exist on the edge of society. For example, cults, religious sects, conspiracy theorists, extremists, and stuff like that. So the sorts of people that Louis Theroux makes documentaries about are typically fringe groups like, you know, neo-Nazis or people who believe in the existence of aliens or religious sects and things like that. Fringe groups. So still talking about Louis Theroux, I think my mum said his naive, awkward English friendliness is very disarming. And as a result, people open up to him. So to be disarming means to make people less hostile or aggressive, perhaps by being charming. Okay, so to disarm someone. So if someone is armed, it means that they've got weapons. Literally, it means they have weapons. Let's say they've got a gun. So if someone is armed, it means they're carrying a gun or a weapon. And if you disarm that person, it means you manage to take that weapon away from them. So that's what it literally means. But it also can mean in a more figurative sense, it can mean that you approach that person in a certain way so that they are not aggressive against you or that they let their defenses down. And they become more open with you, okay? For example, if you're very charming with people, that can disarm them. It means that they lower their defenses. They're not defensive with you, and therefore they're a bit more open with you. So that's to be disarming. So Louis Theroux's sort of awkwardness and his friendliness is quite disarming, and as a result, people open up to him. So to open up to someone means to become more open and revealing with people. For example, to start talking about personal things. So then we moved on to talk about another book, which was called The Year of Reading Dangerously by Andrew Miller, which is a book about, a book about the joy of reading. And we talked about my dad and whether my dad reads a lot. And my mum said that she gave him a copy of that book to try and get him back into the habit of reading because he'd lost the knack of being able to read for pleasure. So the expression here is the knack of doing something. Knack is spelt K-N-A-C-K. It's a silent K. So the knack of doing something. If you have the knack of doing something, it means you have a particular and skillful way of doing something. For example, here's an example of this phrase. There is a certain knack to opening... Sorry, there's a certain knack to closing the bedroom door silently in my flat, okay? There's a knack to it. It's a little tricky to close the bedroom door in my flat quietly. What you have to do is you pull the handle down and then you pull the door in, close the door slowly, and then once it's in, you let the handle go back, okay? And then you pull the end of the handle until you hear a little click. Okay, so there's a knack to doing it. There's a knack to closing the door silently. In this case, my dad has lost the knack of being able to read for pleasure. So to lose the knack of doing something is a common way to say that you've lost the specific ability to do a certain thing. In this case, he's kind of forgotten how to just read for pleasure. Because my dad's a bit of a workaholic. So when he reads, he's normally reading about the news, and it's related to his work in some way, he's lost the knack of just enjoying a good book just for pleasure. That's why my mum gave him that book as a gift. I talked about a book that I read this summer, which was called I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive by Steve Earle. And I said it's about a doctor in the 60s who was a junkie. So a junkie is a drug addict, especially heroin. Heroin is often referred to as junk, meaning this drug, heroin, it's called junk. And if you're a junkie, it means you're addicted to heroin. It's a drug addict. And I said it was a redemptive tale, a story of redemption. So redemption is the process of being redeemed. Well, what does that mean? To redeem yourself means to change your ways, to change from a life of sin or a life of evil or immorality. To change from a life of sin or evil or immorality to a life of good. Okay, so basically to change from being a bad guy to becoming a good guy. So that's to redeem yourself or to get redemption. And the adjective is redemptive. So a redemptive story or a redemptive tale is a tale of redemption, a tale of someone who changes their ways from doing sinful things to doing good things. Okay, so this book by Steve Earle is a kind of tale of redemption, just like a lot of Western movies or Western stories are often redemptive tales. In fact, there's that computer game, that really cool computer game, which is set in the West, and you play the part of like this gunslinger. It's a PlayStation game, and it's also on Xbox, called Red Dead Redemption. It's a kind of cowboy computer game, and it's also a tale of redemption of a guy who starts out as a kind of a criminal, and he gets his revenge, and then he is able to live a peaceful life after that. So that's Red Dead Redemption, the computer game, which is also a tale of redemption. We're nearly finished here. Got just a few more phrases to get through. We talked about Trainspotting 2, which is actually called T2 Trainspotting, the sequel to the 1996 film Trainspotting. I think it's 96. And in that story, they're all addicted to heroin. So here we are again with heroin. And it's really grim. So grim, this adjective means unpleasant and depressing. So as you can imagine, a story of heroin addicts is quite grim, unpleasant and depressing. And we were trying to remember the name of the director. Of course, the director's name is Danny Boyle, but we couldn't remember it at that moment. It's weird that, isn't it? Sometimes when you can't remember, when you're talking to someone and one of you can't remember something, like a word, and when one of you can't remember that word, suddenly neither of you can. Like the memory lapse infects the other person too. That happens all the time, where one of you can't remember something and then neither of you can remember it. That's what happened to us there. So anyway, when you can't remember someone's name, in English we have certain words that we use. So we have words like, what's his name? Which is obviously a question, what is his name? But it turns into one word. You know who I saw the other day? Yeah, you know, I saw, what's his name? So what's his name is actually a word, a replacement for the name of the person who you can't remember. Also, we have what you call him, what you call him. You know, what's his name? What you call him? Hoojama Flip. Hoojama Flip is a good one, isn't it? I understand what's his name. It's a question. What you call him is a question. What do you call him? Hoojama Flip. No idea what that one is. It's a bit ridiculous and quite funny. So, yeah, you know, who I saw the other day, what's his name? You know, what do you call him? Hoojama Flip. You know, oh, Danny Boyle, that's it. Okay, so all words for when you can't remember someone's name. And we were talking about the directing style of Danny Boyle, the film director. And I said it's very in your face. It's intense. It's visceral. So if something is in your face, so, for example, a film, if it's in your face, it means it's bold and direct. It's kind of aggressive, assertive, intense. You can imagine something being right up in your face, like a film. Whoa, intense. A person can be in your face as well. If someone is like really aggressive and assertive, like, oh, he's a bit in your face, isn't he, that guy? And also visceral. So to describe Danny Boyle's films, they're quite visceral. If something is visceral, that's V-I-S-C-E-R-A-L. It means relating to strong feelings or with strong emotions. So it really creates a powerful feeling, you know, a powerful emotive feeling. Okay. And my mum said that she was streaming with tears by the end of the film. So if you're streaming with tears, it means that tears are running down your face. So streaming, you know, like a stream of water or tears in this case. I was streaming with tears means I was crying, like the tears were running down my face. Okay. And then just at the end of the conversation, when we were running out of time, we had a few expressions that we use when there's no more time. Okay. So my mum said, well, the time is getting on. Okay, time is getting on, meaning that it's late. Okay, time is getting on means it's late. And we really ought to draw it to a close. To draw something to a close. We ought to draw it to a close. To draw something to a close means to finish something. To draw it to a close, D-R-A-W. And ought to is just like should. So we really should finish this, or we really ought to draw it to a close. And then the classic phrase, we've run out of time. To run out of time, that's when you've got no time left. We've run out of time, which is appropriate because I think I've run out of time here as well. This episode it's got to be at least an hour and a half long now. Okay, so that's all that there is time for. Time is getting on. I really ought to draw this to a close because I've run out of time. Don't forget to visit the page on the website to see all of that language again, so that you can really kind of learn it properly. Okay, don't forget also to join the mailing list on the website so that you can get a link in your inbox whenever I upload a new episode. It's just a good way of getting straight to the relevant page so you can see vocab and notes and other things that I post. Okay, all right. Thank you so much for listening. I look forward to reading your comments in the comments section if you have any. What did you think of some of the things that we said in this episode? And what do you think of my mum's voice? Do you think she's easy to understand or difficult to understand? I look forward to reading your thoughts. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to Luke's English Podcast.
Goodbye.
For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humor and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.